Dylan?
Yeah, thanks.
Hey, hi, Susan. Good afternoon. We're delighted to see everybody. The House Judiciary Committee is in session in attendance for Representative Grunberg, Lynn, Representative Coghill, myself, Representative Ramirez, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Samuels. Representative Holmes has been in and out. We'll recognize her when she re-arrives. And we are going to open as we did yesterday and as we intend to do tomorrow and Friday with public comment. And then shortly thereafter, we'll have Brooke come up with Representative Newman. So with that, Heidi Dragas again is with us from the Public Employees Local 71. Did not. Heidi, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thanks.
Go ahead, please, Heidi.
I just want to let the committee know that I'm available for questions today. So if there are any, I can entertain those.
Are there any questions for Ms. Dragas? Representative Grunberg.
Yes. Ms. Dragas, we have your testimony here, and there is attached to it a draft text amendment. It's not in the normal form. We would have four amendments.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
I'll yield to Representative
Grunberg. Mr. Chair, I have an amendment to address this issue at the appropriate time.
Okay, so Ms. Dragas, we're not taking amendments at this point, and we have established an order of amendments that we're going to go in. So if you want to stay at the LIO so that you can listen, and you certainly can be available to answer questions. I find that it is unlikely that the committee would pose a question to you. So if you're somewhere where you can sit and relax and enjoy yourself, I would encourage you to do that, but I don't want you to sit on the edge of your seat for 2 hours, because it may be that with the Director of Ethics and the Director of APOC here, and Mr. Jones from the administration and Representative Lynn already having an amendment that covers it, I just want to value your afternoon, but we would be delighted if you have the time to stay online and to participate. But I just, sometimes public gets frustrated if they sit and then their issue is addressed and skipped over in half a minute.
Question, Mr. Chair. Does she have a copy of the amendment? I just need to know.
And Ms. Dragas, are you somewhere where we could fax or provide you a copy of Representative Lynn's amendment?
Yes, I'm at the LAO in Anchorage.
Okay, we will see to it that that is copied to you and will be available for you there at the Anchorage LIO, and it will be a little bit of time before we get there.
Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
And thank you, I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Hold on, Ms. Dragas. Representative Grunberg?
Yes, Ms. Dragas. I would be very grateful, assuming the chair intends to be able to take up the amendment this afternoon, if Ms. Dragas could remain so that she would be available for questions and testimony at that time.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you.
And I will do that. Thank you.
Okay. And thank you for your help and for taking the time out of your schedule to participate with us. All right. With that, Representative Newman. And Ms. Miles, if you'll come up, and we can continue our discussion. Representative Newman, my name gets butchered all the time in its pronunciation and its spelling. And you, on the other hand, have a name that's reasonably easy to spell, but it's linked to common, what's the right word, pop culture. And so I want to share with you this morning, or this afternoon, this photograph. Newman Factor, don't forget the little guy. So with that, Representative Newman, if you and Ms. Miles will present to us the work that you did. Do we have that in a printed form, Brooks? Okay. So if we can pick that up in the appropriate time, we'll try and take up an amendment that... that addresses this. The two of you spent an hour together this morning, is that right? Some time together?
Chair Ramirez, that's correct. And I do have it wrote out here. I just want to make sure that it's clear so that you can read it. And by the way, my name is Representative Mark Newman, District 15. The question that was posed to us, and it was when I talked to Ms. Miles about this morning, we look to our Constitution, and what does our Constitution say? It requires that we have a citizens-based legislature. And so we tried to make sure that we did all we could to ensure that, that we didn't put roadblocks in the way to have that. That being a problem that I felt could inflict or that could be imposed upon my business is reporting transactions with, and we're just going to give a name here of maybe Mr. Peter Miller, who works at the gas station down at the corner, comes to my business and wants a piece of custom furniture built. Mr. Miller has absolutely nothing to do, no business transactions, no substantial political interest with the state of Alaska. We also and we also realize that there's people out there that may be a lobbyist or another legislator, and they would have a substantial political interest with the state of Alaska. I think that we both came to agreement that we should not try and impede if we have to. And the problem, I guess, that we felt is people would come to my business and say, I would just as soon not do business with you because you have to report my name, my address, what you built for me, and how much it cost, for my competitors to know that. And people just like their privacy, you know, and that's another thing that we discussed is, do the citizens of Alaska have a certain implied right to privacy? And I feel that they do. And simply what we discussed is language that would state, legislators shall report any business transition or report the name, address, description of service, and amount paid for their service, which is currently requested. But if an addition on that would be on all transactions with any person or business with substantial political interest within the state of Alaska. Again, trying to work within the system the best that we could to ensure that we have the right to have a citizens-based legislature to allow as many people as we can to participate in the process to be legislators without their business being impaired, without that would not affect their ability for them to earn an income and put food on the table for their family. Ms. Miles, if you'd like to.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, Brooke Miles, I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Public Offices Commission. And first, I'd like to thank Representative Newman for taking an hour of his valuable time this morning to meet with me and discuss this issue. As I said yesterday, one of the most important policy issues that comes before the legislature when dealing with disclosure laws, and that being an individual's right to privacy and public's right to know everything about you, which you're all quite familiar with. I agree so much with Representative Newman that we hate to put blocks before anyone who wants to be a part of this body, the legislative body, and to sit in your seats and write the laws for the great state of Alaska. We certainly don't want to have only independently wealthy people, and we don't want to have only people who perhaps are retired and able to devote that time to. We want to have all people. We want to have everybody. I know all of you feel that way, too. And I can understand that certainly all sources of income that have any kind of relationship with state government activities should definitely be reported. My one concern here is that in putting something of the nature of, you know, only those sources being reported, that would be a step in the opposite direction of what basically House Bill 109 and other measures are trying to do, which is to establish more disclosure. I feel like I just got off the phone with APOC. And one of the recommendations that I would make is that the Commission currently does have an exemption process for people filing financial disclosure reports under the legislative ethics law. And that regulation at this point is very specific with respect to medical procedures, very specific with respect to the legal profession, and very light with respect to businesses. And if the Commission could look at the concerns of the business community, particularly to protect when important the privacy rights of a source of income or to protect the filer with respect to disclosure that could result in unfair business practices and or trade secrets being blown, that might be the best direction to go. Thank you very much again for meeting with me this morning. That's it.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may add to that, too, you know, we discussed different types of business practices and what is fair or not fair to a business. And just, to, again, to being a sole proprietor of a small business, independent-minded. And again, falling back on our Constitution, do everything we can to provide for a citizens-based legislator. We don't want people who are just independently wealthy who can run this job. But Family Guys, you know, a broad scope, and you were very eloquent yesterday when you pointed that out. I wrote down just a brief suggestion here to Ms. Miles as to what we may suggest, and maybe with her agreement we could forward that to the committee.
Okay. So, Representative Newman or Brooke, on the other hand, I feel it's important in my personal capacity. I'm more comfortable with the ethics requirement and the APOC requirement for disclosure of loans. I am more comfortable disclosing that than I am not disclosing it.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to the large cruise ship organizations that I deal with, because I'm going to handle, you know, Ocean Rangers next week. It's contentious. It was one of the lead stories on the Channel 2 News last night.
Mm-hmm.
Contributions to politicians that have, you know, have taken money from the industry, and that the industry is affecting its issues and potentially thwarting the will of the people, was one of the lead stories. So it's important to me that I do disclose that information so that Channel 2 News or somebody else in the media can come to me and say, we had no idea that you had a close relationship with the tourism industry, and then it would reflect on me in a worse fashion to have hidden the information. So as you have the opportunity to draft something, I hope that you can help us craft some language, and that we would be happy to then work on it and have Ledge Legal work on it, that protects Representative Newman so that he can be a member of the citizen legislature, but also protects me so that I don't appear to have done anything unethical, but with a failure to disclose. And therein, I suppose, lies the complexity of precisely the issue that we're taking up, is Mark wants to disclose, or Representative Newman wants to disclose less so that he can maintain his business, and I want to make sure that I'm disclosing enough so that it doesn't appear that I've in any way can be accused of unethical conduct. So I hope that we can find language that's in between those two points, in the same way that Representative Holmes is going to work on the issue that was sensitive to the two members of the legal field that are with us, that many of us feel provides an unfair advantage for attorneys that are going in front of boards and commissions, and members of the legal field feel that they are that their ability to have a vocational pursuit in their field is being curbed or handicapped. And so I hope that when you take up language, that you can find safe harbor between those two points. Mm-hmm. At least those are my thoughts. And Representative Dahlstrom, you brought up some unique concerns that were spousal. And Representative Lynn?
Well, when you're ready, I'm just going to make a couple comments on it. I'm trying to understand this. When you make and I've never seen your furniture, I've heard many good things about it. When you craft a piece of furniture, other than the cost of the wood, it's a very unique, it's a one-of-a-kind thing. And what's the value? Let's say instead of being a cabinet maker or a furniture maker, that you are an artist, made beautiful paintings. Well, what's the value of a beautiful painting? Well, it's the cost of the canvas, the cost of the wood, the brushes, and so on. But what the value of that painting is what somebody's willing to pay for it. The cost of a Rembrandt, material-wise, is next to nothing. It has great value. So when What if I were an artist making paintings? How would I disclose? Would my disclosing what you paid for my painting, would that hurt my business as an artist when I craft the next painting?
Through the chair, Representative Villain, we did discuss artists, we discussed architects, we discussed mechanical engineers or people in the mechanical fields of construction, quite a range of different people. And we felt that, again, there's a certain amount of trust that's implied to us by the public when they elect us. We know who those people are that have substantial political interests with the state of Alaska. If there's any question, I don't think that there's not one person in this room that doesn't call APOC and find out. And when we discussed that, we decided that APOC was very capable of making those decisions in that description, you know, and leave it up to the people who know what they're doing, that look at this every day, to the professionalism of APOC to try and decide that. And if there's questions beyond that, it goes to the commission itself, which is a commission that has new people coming into it every year. It's politically neutral. And that's what we came up with. What is the value of that? But again, the thing, my stance on it is we should report anything with any dealings that we have, any business or company that has any substantial political interest.
Okay. Representative Dahlstrom?
Just a comment or clarification, Representative Newman. My understanding is the conceptual amendment that you presented to us, it states that we would, whatever we decide that is to be declared, then it would go to the commission. If they request more information, they would ask that of us, and they would be making the decision. That's correct?
Yes, but we have to have certain, through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, there is certain language that needs to be put into statute to guide APOC. That being that we, as legislators, should report any business transactions with substantial political interest. If there's questions, we should ask the people at APOC for clarification on that.
Okay. So at this point, you're welcome. So at this point, as we close public testimony for the day, Brooke, are you clear on, do you want to get with Jane Pearson?
Yes.
And we're trying to run it through Ledge Legal to draft it into an amendment that we can take up tomorrow. And Mark, Representative Newman, if you have time tomorrow at 1:30, when we start to take up amendments, we will take up this amendment first, if your schedule allows, or let us know between 1:30 and 3 when is the best time for you. That way you can be in the room as we...
1:30.
I'm sorry. Just for housekeeping, from 1:30 until 2 o'clock tomorrow will be a special segment on blind trusts. We have Dave Schaftel will be online with us, and Representative Seaton wants to address this as a specific concern of his. So I would say maybe 2:30 tomorrow, if your schedule allows. Representative Newman, you could be down here. We could take up this amendment specifically. So with consent to the members, we'll stop what we're doing at 2:30 to respect Representative Newman's time. We'll take up that amendment and the debate, invite you up to participate in that so that you feel included as this issue comes up.
And Chair Ramirez, certainly I will make room in my schedule for this, but this is not just my amendment, but amendment that was drafted conceptually with the APOC director, Brooke Miles, and myself.
Thank you. And we recognize that this is really applicable to every vocation, short of the legal profession, which we dealt with yesterday, and hopefully with Representative Holmes's and Gruenberg's help, we will see a revised approach at doing something that enjoys the majority of the committee. So we thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it a lot. And thank you, Representative Newman and Ms. Miles. We'll keep you in the hot seat and at the ready for, and you got her warmed up. You might as well sit tight. Okay, so with that, for the day, public comment is closed. And as I say, tomorrow at 1:30, we will take up a blind trust in particular. And Representative Seaton will come in and address the committee on that point. Representative Gruenberg?
I also notified Paul Richards so he could get the trust lawyers and people who deal with that professionally. Is he going to be coming by? Yeah, I talked to him this morning.
I think that's who we've arranged with this gentleman, Dave Shaftel.
Oh, yeah, Dave, sure, absolutely.
Is the person who will approach that. Okay, so with that, we're going to take up, we will take up amendments again. And Representative Coghill, because you had to leave, we stopped at 2:45 with, because many of the amendments that were left on the table were your amendments, and we wanted you to have the opportunity to speak with them. So I would, Jane Pearson, in order to keep us organized, has written out a schedule to make it easier to reference specific amendments. If we can take up amendment number 9 by Representative Coghill, should be page 21, line 21 is the...
Yes.
I have this down as amendment number 9. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
Hi.
Hi.
What is the number in the upper right or something?
It's 25-GH1059/O, dated 3707.
Oh, I see, it's at the beginning, okay.
Representative Coghill?
I understand this is table, so I'd ask unanimous consent that we bring it off the table, that we might consider amendment number 9. If there's any objection.
Any objection, thank you for, it's nice to have the rules chairman sitting on the committee. No objection, we have amendment number 9 before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for letting me exit earlier. I did get a bill through the other body's committee, so...
Well done.
It was worthwhile.
Well done.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 9.
And I'll object for discussion.
Okay, we have amendment number 9 before us.
Mr. Chairman, this is an amendment that I decided I would become a conduit for. And so, just to remind the body, and this is one that the administration feels very strongly about. This is on the reporting dollar amounts on page 21. The public official that must report under Title 39, which is executive ethics, we amended in there that they report the sources of income. And we modified in subcommittee from 1,000 to 5,000. And the question that I had to answer in my own mind, and I'll look for the answer from the administration, is kind of what Representative Newman was bringing up. At what point does it become just so difficult to comply that it becomes more burdensome than valuable to the public to know? And so I think that's the question that I'm looking for the answer. And with that, I'd ask that we have Mr. Jones speak to it.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dave Jones. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. Representative Coghill, through the chair, your question is a good one. Anytime we require additional disclosure or ratchet down the restrictions on activities of public officials, we run the risk at the margins of discouraging folks from accepting positions in public service. And there's constantly a balancing act between serving the public's interest in disclosure and assuring that their public representatives are acting ethically, and our ability to recruit and retain qualified, competent folks in state service. We believe that the $1,000 threshold is the appropriate threshold for several reasons. First, by initiative, the Alaska voters in August of last year indicated that $1,000, they thought, was the appropriate threshold for disclosure of legislators' income. And we think what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If that's the appropriate threshold for legislators, why not for other public officials, members of the executive branch, judicial officers, and municipal officers? In addition, $1,000 to most folks is a good amount of money. And if you have any question about that, think about efforts to take away permanent fund dividends, which are often near that $1,000 mark. The other part of this amendment would require disclosure in all circumstances of the number of hours worked to earn income over $1,000. As it currently stands, the bill would require disclosure of the number of hours worked only if the money was earned on an hourly basis. Well, what this wouldn't reach is the sweet deal. For example, I have a contract with someone for $50,000. I'm not being paid on an hourly basis, but I happen to do only 1 hour of work because I have extremely valuable services to offer. Well, if the public doesn't know that, the public doesn't understand that this may be a sweet deal. It may be from someone who's expecting something special from me as a member of the executive branch. And by requiring disclosure of hours in all circumstances, I think we help assure the public that there aren't these sweet deals going on.
Questions for Mr. Jones? Is the objection maintained, Representative Grunberg?
Yeah.
Is there any additional discussion on the matter? All right. Representative Cockrell?
Maybe I should just on a couple of matters. This is not just only about income earned. This is about transactions. And so I think we need to be clear. In the legislative portion, we talk about loans and we talk about income, but this is really about transactions as well. And I think there might be a little bit of difference, and maybe I should ask Mr. Jones to maybe go down through sections sub 2, 4, and 5 and just kind of describe how the reporting process might work in each one of those, just so that we have an idea about the difference between the income issue and the movement of money, because I think it's right to ask, is the movement of money ethical? And then the next question is $1,000 or $5,000 the right amount to make it an ethical question? So if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chairman, before we vote.
Mr. Jones?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Representative Coghill, you're absolutely correct. The $1,000 threshold would apply not only to income earned, but also trusts or fiduciary relations in which the reporter or the reporter's spouse, domestic partner, or dependent child holds a beneficial interest. The $1,000 reporting threshold would apply to loans or loan guarantees, would also, well, that may be the extent of it then.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Maybe I should ask if, if, for example, I have a credit line. Now, I don't have a very big credit line, but I have a credit line, and I use it frequently. And so this year I reported in my financial disclosure that I have this credit line because I've often used it over the $1,000 mark. That's also true here. And so the what about credit cards? What about credit lines? What do we have to do there? Help me understand.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, I'll defer to Ms. Miles on the nuts and bolts of the reporting requirements. My understanding is that it would not apply to a credit card, but would to a credit line, unless that credit line were through a credit card arrangement.
Ms. Miles?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The reporting requirements do not ask that you do credit cards or revolving credit accounts at stores. But a line of credit, even if it was attached to a credit card, would be reportable. Also, Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Yes.
These changes under AS 3950 do conform with the requirements under AS 2460, because the disclosure requirements under AS 2460 begin with legislators, legislative employees, and the public members of the Select Committee on will report all the things that are required under AS 3950-030. So it's the same.
Thank you. Are there other comments?
One other comment, and then I'll yield. I understand the cost of a bicycle and the value of a dividend might be something that'll be worthy of reporting. And I understand that that was in the initiative on the income, for sure. And I think AS 2460-200 talks about both the loan guarantee and the income, if I remember correctly now. But I just struggle with it. Is that really an ethical problem? And I haven't been satisfied with it, but I'm trying to generate some discussion, but I'm not going to borrow money for a bicycle, but the value of a bicycle is what we're talking about. Anyway, just I wanted to complain, so I'm complaining.
I understand. My own thoughts on this issue and others is it's difficult to run for public office. There are a lot of elements of it that I don't like. I like going door to door after I've been doing it for half an hour, but that first half hour is icy water. I don't like filling out ethics reports, and I don't like filling out APOC reports, and I really hate when I have to make numerous phone calls to both agencies to make sure I did it right, but I sure do feel a lot better when I'm sitting in here and I have disclosed it and I'm not as concerned about conflicts that have been raised. And so for me, I like low common denominators, even though they're unpleasant initially, because I think they offer clarity later, and I appreciate clarity. So to that end, I am going to support amendment number 9.
Yeah. Representative Ellsworth?
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. On all sources of incomes, and we've talked about that being transactions also. So if I say I do day trading or something like that, and do I need to disclose then every month or every quarter
where
I'm at, or every transaction, which could be maybe 10 times in a 24-hour period and then could go for days with nothing? That's a question. And then my other question pertains to the reporting of credit lines attached to credit cards. In my mind, sometimes I think I'm doing business very smartly if I know I've got a check coming and I have this credit line attached to my credit card that's attached to my bank account and there's no interest attached to it, and I can make a payment in full so I don't make any interest payment on my regular credit card, and then that statement comes and I pay that. But if I understand this correctly, I'm going to have to then report each one of those transactions to be in compliance. Am I right or wrong?
If I may interject before you answer that question, I have to list as a relationship Northern Bank.
Right.
But I don't list it every time I go into the credit line. I list that as an ongoing relationship throughout the year. So if I went and got a second credit line at First National Bank of Anchorage, then I would have to also list that as a credit relationship. So if you have a Bank of America credit card and you do tap that as a line of credit, then yes, you would have to list it. But if you tapped it 15 times throughout the year, you wouldn't have to list it 15 times. It's the same relationship.
Okay, so then, Mr. Chair,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Great answer.
But for clarification, so then it's so the part where the sources of income means transactions, do we need to clarify that it's not every single transaction? Again, you know, my intent, I want to do this right. And so I just want to make sure that.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom, through the chair. The provision 3950.030(b)(1) says that for all sources of income over $5,000 during the preceding year. So that allows the consolidation for the entire year that the chair referred to.
Okay.
And with regard to the second point, which was trading, yes. Because if sometimes you can make $1,000 or lose it in a 15-minute cycle. Sometimes it could take you all year to do it. So the answer is yes. If you buy and sell, that is the nature of the transaction. And if it results in a gain of more than $1,000, it needs to be reported. And it doesn't matter the time frame in which it happened, a day or 11 months and 29 days. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so just a how that process would work. I would need to keep track of that all year, and at the end of the year, submit one one report with every day's transactions, or the expectation would be that with every transaction that I made over 1,000 or 5,000 or 1,000, if we change it to that, that I would then send you an updated report that day?
It's annual.
It would be an annual report. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And the requirement is no greater than what you have to report to the federal government.
That's right.
So potentially, Mr. Chair, I could have just on that section a 365-page report just on that, correct? If I trade every day.
If you were a day trader, that's possible. It wouldn't be only under sources. Yes, and you show that, and it would be if you had the over $1,000 transactions. Yes.
Okay.
Representative Samuels.
I want to follow up on Representative Dalton's questions. I'm trying to shut up.
I'm not going to be a day trader.
And so a legislator.
If I have a stock portfolio, or
right.
Let's say it's an individual stock in the Cog Hill Pipeline Company, and I make $1,000 a day every day for the first 6 months of the year, and I lose $1,000 a day every day for the last 6 months of the year, and I did not make any money on an annual basis, do I have to issue reports for every day? Because it is a transaction, it's a source of income. So I have to report, even though on an annual basis, I broke even or I lost my shorts. I made $5,000 on one day and I lost $5,000 a day.
But my portfolio
is gone.
But Representative Samuels, you doesn't say anything about reporting capital losses. It does,
right.
It does say you have to report capital gains.
I see.
And so you do have to report every gain. If you have 40 transactions that result in an individual capital gain of more than $1,000, you have to report that. If you have offsetting ones, that's between you and the federal government. But the APOC is not interested. APOC is not interested in your capital losses. We don't address that. So, and a gain can happen in 15 minutes. A gain can happen in 30 days. It can happen in over a long period of time. So, but you do not have to show the dollar volume, nor how many shares of each stock you had. All you have to do is report that you bought and sold IBM, you bought and sold Walt Disney, you bought and sold General Motors.
That's right.
And the APOC is not concerned about the volume of the gain. You are declaring that it is greater than the amount specified, that you have exceeded that threshold. And it's a great one in which to over-report. It's because often that's how your broker will put things out, is you had all these transactions, and if you're lucky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that all those phone calls might have helped a little, huh?
Yeah. Good listener. Thank you, ma'am. All right. Is Representative Gruenberg, is the objection maintained?
Just a second.
Good job at APOC after you leave here.
Yeah. Yes, the objection is maintained. What this will do, and don't forget, what we're talking about here are cabinet officers and high-level executive positions. It's not easy to get people into government service at this point. They're often taking a very substantial cut in their annual income. They're people who have substantial assets in many cases, and they have a long, I'm certain in most cases, expectation and desire for normal privacy. And to have every single stock transaction that may have momentarily had a gain, or I guess it would be on an annual basis, your 1099, that would be the standard, be your 1099 that would be reported, without reporting the offsetting losses, could give a very, very skewed idea of the person's income, and the press would be given not an accurate picture, neither would the public, and this would significantly discourage good people of some means from entering government service. These people are not necessarily in the same income bracket most of us are in, and there are not that many people who are involved, and they're people who the state really needs to have involved in the workings of government. And a person, $1,000 today, $1,000 at one time was worth a lot more than it is today, I seriously doubt whether most of the voting public gave great thought to whether it was $1,000 or $5,000. And it was a large initiative that dealt with the legislature. Whether the voting public would have said the same thing with respect to the executive branch is purely conjecture. And the subcommittee looked at this at some length. We discussed this at great length. And we made this very considered decision. We could have gone higher. But $5,000 today is a fairly low amount for people in this category.
Very good. Susan, will you take the roll, please?
Representative Dahlstrom.
Yes.
Representative Coghill.
No.
Representative Samuels.
Yes.
Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Representative Holmes is not present. Representative Gruenberg.
No.
Representative Ramos.
Yes.
4 yes, 2 no.
Okay, so amendment number 9 passes. We took up amendment number 10 and passed it yesterday. We have before us now Jane, I'm confused. I've got the next in this book. Did you order these, or are they still the order? I have Gruenberg up here. Okay. Okay. I see. So this is where the order is? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Okay. I understand. Thank you.
I'm a little lost here. Oh, where are we?
Yes, ma'am.
Do I know?
Okay. So we have before us now amendment number 11 by Representative Gruenberg, 25-GH1059/0.36. Representative Gruenberg, the floor is yours.
I'd like to move the amendment.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is one that we passed over yesterday. That was, I believe, a Ramos amendment initially. And we said we were going to have it redrafted. It is the prohibition concerning spouse lobbying. And this was taken from the bill that is making its way through Congress, and it's somewhat similar to an amendment that would amend the rules of the U.S. Senate. It would prohibit a legislator or legislative employee from communicating directly with the spouse or domestic partner of the legislature if that person, the spouse or domestic partner, is registered as a lobbyist under AS 24.45.041, and the communication concerns legislative action. And legislative action is already defined in AS 24.45.171. And the members hopefully have their blue books and can turn to that that section, Mr. Chair. If people would like me to read that into the record, I'm happy to read the definition. And I think this is very clearly constitutional because it regulates the members themselves and their employees.
Mr. Chairman, that citation again?
The citation is 24.45.171, and the term legislative action is in subsection 9, and I'm happy to read that if you would like.
Please do.
Okay. Quote, legislative action means the preparation, research, drafting, introduction, consideration, modification, amendment, approval, passage, enactment, defeat, or rejection of any bill, resolution, amendment, motion, report, nomination, appointment, or other matter by the legislature, or by a standing interim or special committee of the legislature, or by a member or employee of the legislature acting in an official capacity. It includes but is not limited to the action of the governor in approving or vetoing a bill, or the action of the legislature in considering overriding or sustaining that veto, and the action of the legislature in considering confirming or rejecting an executive appointment of the governor.
Is there a discussion? Representative Samuels?
This gets away from the prohibition, although first of all, a technical question is, the way I'm reading this is a legislator, so I cannot communicate directly with the spouse of a legislator, Nancy's husband, if he's a registered lobbyist, which means if your husband were a registered lobbyist, he couldn't talk to any legislators. That's the way I'm reading this.
May I respond?
Wouldn't be a very good lobbyist.
The legislators or employees could not speak to the spouse of another legislator who is A, registered as a lobbyist, and B, only concerning matters within the definition of lobbying. You can talk to the spouse about anything else, but not concerning lobbying activity, the legislative activities.
So essentially you just, excuse me.
Representative Samuels.
Chairman, thank you. Essentially you're going to the same place, you still can't lobby then. You can register as a lobbyist, you just can't talk to anybody.
You can't lobby the legislature. You can lobby the executive branch.
Okay. Is
there other discussion?
With her spouse?
And I'm sorry. This is, in one respect, different from the bill that's moving through Congress. The provision that's moving through Congress only limits the communications to members of that body. So the spouse of a senator could lobby members of the House. This is broader because it would prohibit lobbying against both houses, and I don't necessarily feel strongly if that's a distinction that's important to the members of the committee.
Thank you. I'll maintain my objection. Is there any other discussion?
Sure.
Representative Lynn?
So, if my wife were a lobbyist, you could not talk to her about a bill that I was considering. Is that correct?
I believe, Representative Lynn, you could not talk to her about any issue in the legislature.
I could not
talk about the weather.
That's going to be very difficult to
enforce.
I'm going to vote no on the amendment, also that the perception would be, so if I were the Senate president or the chairman of the Finance Committee with in a tremendous amount of influence on a particular piece of the governor's legislation, and my wife was a lobbyist and went to lobby somebody who wanted this piece of legislation, the perception is just going to be there. And the perception, I mean, is what ethics is all about. The perception will be there that, you know, Mrs. Samuels is out there getting some money from Company A while her husband has the bill in Committee B over here, and their perception is, I think, what we're trying to get away from, so I'll be voting no.
Is there other discussion?
One comment. I agree that we don't want spouses lobbyists because of that very perception, but I agree also with the majority leader on this one. I just don't think we've gotten there yet.
Susan, will you take the roll, please, on Amendment Number 11?
Representative Coghill.
No.
Representative Samuels.
No.
Representative Lynn.
No.
Representative Holmes is not present. Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom.
No.
Representative Ramirez.
No.
One yes, five no.
Okay, so Amendment Number 11 fails. We have before us Amendment Number 12 by Representative Ramirez, 25-GH1059/0.31.
This is 12.
This is 12, that's correct.
Where was the amendments?
It begins with page 9, following line 10. Do all the members have that before them?
Yes.
This is a section that deals with contracts and leases. Mr. Jones, can you help us with this, please?
Do my best, Mr. Chairman. I believe that this amendment is aimed at requiring prompt publication of disclosures of legislators and legislative employees' interests in state contracts and leases. And Ms. Anderson, if you please, has indicated an interest in addressing.
Joyce, thank you very much. It's nice to see you.
For the record, Joyce Anderson, Administrator for the Select Committee.
Who objected to this?
Do we have, I'll object for discussion.
Representative Dahlstrom's objection, so we're number 12 before us. I'm sorry about that. Go ahead, Joyce.
Joyce Anderson, Administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. This really is cleanup language for the Ethics Code. This particular section on contracts and leases did not have that the disclosure shall be published in the journal. All other disclosures are published. They have been published up to this point based on the precedents in the committee that all of them are disclosed. So this is just making it set in language.
Okay. Is there a discussion? Representative Kako?
I think one of the other things that we reported to put in the journal also came up, and the question came, how do we do it electronically? How are we doing there? Can you bring that up at this point?
Representative Coghill, through the chair, you and I have had a discussion about electronic filing. That was a discussion we had in February when I was here for the House State Affairs Committee. I will be checking into that during the interim. Haven't had time during this session, unfortunately. but I will be checking into it. Our discussion revolved around possibly checking with some other states to see if they have a program that might be similar to what we need and purchase a program and then adapt it to our needs instead of starting from scratch. So that is something that I will be working on. And then at that point, they would be able to be filed online, and the House Clerk and Senate Secretary would then be able to take that information from online and automatically be able to put it in the journal instead of re-entering the information, which is the current practice.
I just wanted to bring the committee up to speed on a discussion that we'd had, and it's a needed thing. There's a lot of volume here.
And I'll remove my objection, Mr. Chair.
All right. We have Amendment Number 12 before us. Is there any objection to Amendment Number 12? Seeing none, Amendment 12 passes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
On the previous amendment, Number 11, I left something out that I think is important, and I do apologize.
We show great deference and courtesy here, Representative Grunberg.
We adopted an amendment yesterday, and it was Amendment Number 2, I believe, that dealt with lobbying by spouses. And when we adopted it, it was with the understanding that there was some significant potential constitutional problems with that. And I have two legal opinions that Mr. Cohen was trying to get me to reference when we were discussing this, and I kind of got bollocksed up a little bit, and I didn't do it. And that was the reason I brought Amendment 11 before us today. It was being drafted yesterday. And what I'd like to do, Mr. Chair, is at some point revisit those two amendments, and maybe we'll do it tomorrow. I'll distribute the two memos tonight.
Okay.
So that the members can look at this. It was an attempt to cure a constitutional problem.
Very good. And we'd appreciate if you'd also draft those as new amendments.
The legal opinions are in the packet.
Okay, the legal opinions are already in the back cover.
Oh, they're in the packet?
Yes.
Oh, okay. They're, should I reference them for your review?
Yes.
They're.
How about at the time? We can proceed.
Oh, I just got it. So I.
Oh, you want to reference the legal opinions?
The legal opinions, okay. So that the members can look at these overnight. The two amendments in question are numbers 2 and 11. And the two legal opinions are dated February 26 and February 28. And they're from Alpheus Bullard to me, attention, Norman Cohen, and they deal with the this proposed statutory change that would prohibit the spouse or domestic partner from being a lobbyist. And he said that he thought was unconstitutional, and then he came up with the other as a fix for it. And I'll just see if we can put that on the agenda. Thank you.
Jane, do you have that? Okay. All right, we have before us Amendment Number 13 by Representative Ramirez, 25-GH1059/0.27.
I'll move it.
Object.
Representative Dahlstrom moved the amendment. It's objected to by Representative Samuels. We have Number 13 before us for discussion. Page 9, line 27. And Joyce, is this appropriate content for you to speak to, please?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, this is actually cleanup language from a discussion on Monday at the committee when we were talking about exempting the publication of a disclosure because it may be an invasion of the person's privacy. This was new language that was put in here. And on line 27, it just stated a quorum of the committee. So we have made it to say, a quorum of the committee determines by a majority vote of the committee members who are present. So we've actually made it by a majority vote. And this would be, I worked with legal on this to put committee members who are present because we have a 9-member committee. We need 3 members from the public body of the committee to be present for a quorum, and we need 2 legislative members from the 4 legislative members. So we could actually have a 5-member committee present, and so we felt that it would be better to say who are present versus having all 9 members, because sometimes it's very difficult to get members together. So I just want to point that out in case the committee has any discussion regarding that. Also on page 17, line 31, that language was added into a section that was added as well as the complaint process, just to make the 2 sections consistent as to what the committee is, how the committee needs to make those determinations.
Very good. Representative Samuel.
Thank you. And that's exactly the point I was going to ask about is I'm usually more comfortable that a majority of the committee members should be setting the policy. It could change the vote. Just depend on who happens to show up at the meetings. How often do you have this problem? So if you had 5 out of 9 show up, so you actually had a quorum, now you need, out of a 9-person committee, you're setting policy with 3. You're setting policy with a third.
And Representative Samuels, this was drafted by legal, and so we had a discussion about that this morning, and that's why I was bringing it up to the committee to see if that's what they wanted to do or if they wanted to just say a majority of the committee members.
I would offer an amendment to the amendment to delete the words who are present and who are present that. I'm you 3 out of 9 making policy decisions, I'm less comfortable. And I realize it's more of a burden on you to make sure you can only do it at meetings, but that's...
Very good. The amendment to the amendment is accepted. We have amendment 13 before us. Representative Grunberg?
Having sat on that committee for 2 years, I do recall it is seldom that all the members are there. If I may ask Ms. Anderson, and I'm trying to think how often this amendment to the amendment would prevent the committee from acting.
Representative Groombrook, through the chair, actually I feel with the new legislation that is in this bill that would pass that would allow an alternate member to sit in when a regular member is unable to attend would definitely help with the makeup of the committee and the numbers present. So I don't believe that this is necessary. The deletion would be okay.
I'll withdraw my objection to the amendment to the amendment.
Okay. All right. So we have amendment number 13 before us amended. Is the main objection maintained?
No, sir.
Objection is lifted. Is there any other objection? Seeing none, amendment 13 passes. We have before us amendment number 14 by Representative Ramirez, 25-GH1059/0.30. Wayne?
I'll move it.
Page 10, following line 4. Moved by Dahlstrom.
Yeah.
Objection by Samuels. We have amendment number 14 before us for discussion. Joyce, can you help us with this, please?
Mr. Chairman and committee members. This recommendation was made just recently after a discussion with Brooke Miles about individuals who are required to file financial disclosures. It is my understanding that there are certain cities that have elected and appointed public officials that are allowed to exempt themselves from filing financial disclosures by going to the voters and ask for that process. And one of them, for instance, is the city of Cordova. And so our feeling is, and if I can speak for Brooke, our feeling is that we feel that if they're a public official, they're a public official. It doesn't matter whether they file a financial disclosure or not. If there is a close economic association, it needs to be disclosed. So we're removing the requirement to file a financial disclosure and just going with the definition of a public official in AS 3950.
All right, very good. Representative Holmes has joined us. Nice to see you. The objection is removed. Is there any additional discussion? Seeing no objection, amendment number 14 passes. We have before us amendment number 15.
I'll move number 15.
25-GH1059/0.17. Moved by Dahlstrom.
I'll object, Mr. Chairman.
Coghill, Representative Coghill objects for the purposes of discussion. We have amendment number 15 before us, referencing page 11, line 18. Joyce?
Mr. Chairman and committee members. This is a section under 2460.030, which has to do with the exemptions for the or conflicts of interest, and it has to do with the gift of transportation from a legislator to a legislator. And the reason that this change is suggested, and I have another change as well because I don't think it was quite drafted the way the recommendation was made, but a gift of transportation from a legislator to a legislator is okay, but we also have legislators who own airplanes and would want to take their staff person along with them. So we really need to say, or the staff person may have an airplane and take the legislator along. So we need to say a gift of transportation from a legislator or legislative employee to a legislator or legislative employee. So there is no type of gift disclosure that needs to be required because they're actually.
And so Joyce, conceptually, what did you say? It needs additional language?
We actually need to say after from a legislator or legislative employee, and then it says to a legislator on line 18. After the second word legislator, we need to say or a legislative employee as well.
That's in there too.
It's the second line.
I'm sorry. I didn't see that on the second line. Okay. We're fine.
Okay. So no additional language is necessary. Representative Greenberg.
Yeah, I'm going to object because it says a gift of transportation from a legislator to a legislative employee in a motor vehicle. Does that mean I have to disclose it every time I give my staff a lift?
Currently?
Well, currently it doesn't because it doesn't cover that. But I mean, it could if I were foolish enough to give the chair a lift down to the bottom of the hill. Do I have to, he's foolish enough to take the ride. Do I have to disclose that? I mean, certainly we don't mean that, I would hope.
Certainly.
Representative Greenberg through the chair, no.
I don't know. We're going to be having this bill a couple more days. I'm not going to object to the amendment, but I'd like you and the staff to look and see if we have to do anything else technically to this, because we're not talking about that. And I'm going to remove my objection.
Representative Cockham?
Just a point of information. Isn't this anything over $250? Or is this any time? I haven't studied this out. So.
Representative Coghill through the chair. This is in the gift section. This was this section was actually put in, I believe, in 2001, the first year that I came on board. And I'm not quite sure what the background is as to why this was put in here. But I have had requests over time stating that a legislator, let's say from the Bush, wanted to take a legislative employee with them on a trip. And the way this has been interpreted through our offices is that it would be a gift. And so it would be a gift because the legislator is going with the legislator on a legislative business trip where there's gas and so forth and so on. So this is actually an exemption. This becomes an exemption under the gift statute.
Okay.
So that's why we wanted to add legislative employee.
So we don't have to report?
No, no.
We don't?
No.
Oh, then I'm fine. I was back.
It's an exemption. It's an exemption.
Okay.
I can drive you home tonight.
Thank you. I hope you won't.
To Anchorage?
No, objection. Is the objection maintained?
I have the objection. I don't.
All right. So we have amendment number 15 before. Seeing no objection, amendment 15 passes. We now have before us amendment number 16, Ramris 25-GH1059/0.18.
I'll move that, please.
Dahlstrom moves it.
I'll object, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill objects for the purposes of discussion. We have 16 before us. Joyce, back to you.
Representative Ramris and committee members, this is just a cleanup language, adding the word the. It's just adding the word the to the sentence to make it read better.
We talked about this yesterday, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this is the 30 days after receiving a gift.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong amendment. It was 18.
This takes the March 15th type and puts it after 30 days receiving the gift.
Right. I apologize.
You had me going, though. I was looking at it. Where's the?
Oh, I see this right. Page 12, line 19. Right, correct. We have 16 before us. Is the objection maintained?
Oh, my
point
eight,
it's 0.18.
Yes. Yes, that's correct.
Amendment 16.
And I'll remove my objection. It's just conforming language.
Conforming language amendment. We have 16 before us. Seeing no objection, number 16 passes. We have before us amendment number 17, which is 25-GH1059/0.19.
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
Dahlstrom moves it.
How could we object?
Seeing no objection, number 17 passes. So we now have before us amendment number 18, which is 25-GH1059/0.21, Wayne.
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
What's the number on
that? I have 0.32,
I see. Yeah, the two are identical.
Oh, this is withdrawn.
Yeah,
what's the number on this, Mr. Chair?
0.2 is 0.21, and it's amendment number 18, Representative Wayne.
Oh.
This begins with page 16, line 17, delete in January of each year, insert within 10 days of the first each regular session of the legislature.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, we talked about this before.
Thank you.
Yes.
And Representative Dahlstrom moved it. Need an objection to get it before us for discussion?
Okay, I'll object.
Representative Coghill objects for the purposes of discussion. Representative Grunberg?
We might not be meeting in January if under the new rules.
Accommodation bill.
We'll be in front of the State Affairs Committee talking about this, but it could very well be that we want to have it within 10 days of the first regular session. So
right.
I'll remove my objection. This is to do with the training issues, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Joyce, does that cause a problem for us?
With the language as stated in the amendment, no.
And if the session date changes, does that cause a problem?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, there's flexibility in this language because at other times determined by the committee. So I think there's flexibility in there.
Okay, the objection's been removed. Seeing no objections, amendment number 18.
Hmm. 0.35 is the same thing. We should just skip over that, Mr. Chair.
Same thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Jane, I don't see point
slightly
two.
Slightly out of order.
A little bit out of order? Okay. Okay. So let's go to 25-GH1059/0.29. Wayne?
I got it.
Slightly out of.
This would be amendment number 19. Is that right? Do you need some help?
0.29.
The two are backwards.
0.29.
I hear no objection to amendment number 19. Representative Gruenberg?
I'm just, please just give me a minute.
Right.
I'm slightly above.
Okay.
This is where we put in a lefet.
Yeah, right.
A course.
Okay.
Would somebody like to object for the purposes of discussion? Dahlstrom objects for the purposes of discussion. We have amendment number 19 before us.
Yeah, this is, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg?
I think this is fine. This is just what we've been dealing with.
I'll remove my objection, Mr. Chair.
The objection is removed. We have amendment number 19 before us. Seeing no objection, amendment number 19 passes. We have before us amendment number 20. 25-GH1059/0.15 Wayne begins with page 16, line 23, following complete.
I'll move that.
Whoa. Moved by Dahlstrom.
Object, Mr. Chairman.
I don't know where it is. Of discussion. Okay. We have amendment number 20 before us by Gruenberg. Representative Gruenberg.
Stand by, Mr. Chair. I need to find it here.
This is
okay.
This is the same.
Mr. Chair, if I could interject, this is an amendment that would change what we just passed, an amendment number 19.
So we shouldn't offer
it? Right.
Okay. I'm not going to offer. Let's not label that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Amendment number 20 is withdrawn.
There you go.
Now are we doing okay for you? Are you? Yes, we're doing fine? We have before us amendment number 21, 25-GH1059/0.34. Lockup.
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
Dahlstrom.
That's 21.
0.34.
Mr. Chair, that's 21.
That is correct, Representative Lynn. Page 25, line 27, following 5,000 by Representative Gruenberg.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah. This is what this would state, that if the value of the stock is less than $5,000, if it's more than 1% of the total value of the stock, it is not insignificant. And the reason for this is because quite often, particularly in closely held corporations, it's difficult to determine exactly what the value of the stock is. And again, in the Senate version, they use 1%. It's much easier often to determine the percentage ownership you have. And that's why I believe that you could have an interest that is significant, even though you don't know the exact value. And rather than going through potentially a lengthy hearing to determine the value of the stock if it ever becomes litigated, all they'd have to do is determine that, in fact, you do own more than 1%. And if so, then it must be disclosed, and the officer must disqualify herself if necessary.
Representative Pago.
Let me get Mr. Jones to speak to this.
Yes, please, Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Coghill.
Do I have an objection to the amendment number 21?
I'll object.
Representative Coghill, an objection to number 21. Of course, Mr. Jones, thank you. Pardon me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Coghill. The difficulty with this amendment is that it would require the Attorney General, the designated ethics supervisors, and the Personnel Board to determine in every case whether an interest was both less than $5,000 in value and less than 1% of the total stock in the business or the total value of the business. I believe it's going to be more difficult in most circumstances to calculate 1% as opposed to the value of the business. Furthermore, if the interest is worth less than $5,000, do we care what percentage it is of the business? Because what really matters to folks is how much money is at stake. And if it's less than $5,000, we made the determination that it's insignificant or presumptively insignificant. And so it really isn't germane to the ultimate decision, that is this an ethical thing to be doing, to find out what percentage that constitutes of the whole.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. And the concern that I have about the amendment goes to book value. And book value is a more complicated figure to address than an investment. If I invest $5,000 into a fully depreciated business, it may have a very low book value. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to determine what percentage of the
that works opposite. May I, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
It's difficult. The book value may have very little relation to the actual value of the stock, particularly if we're talking about a potential conflict of interest, that if the executive is allowed to participate, may dramatically increase the value of the stock. And the question is, do you look at the value of the stock before or after the action? And let's say you have a stock that's has very little value, and then if you grant the permit, it's going to go out of sight. That's what I'm concerned about as far as determining the ownership. Simply the executive who wanted to exempt herself from this prohibition would simply indicate the number of shares outstanding and the number of shares she owned.
Representative Samuels?
Thank you. I just want to give my example, make sure I'm reading this correctly. If you have to follow both standards, the 5,000 and the 1%, I could own $1 million of shares of ConocoPhillips, which would probably be less than 1% of the total value of the company.
Right.
And it would not be disposable, and yet I would be doing business because I have to follow both standards. It's presumed insignificant if the value is less than 5,000 and 1% of the total value. No, no, I'm going backwards now.
Stock or other
small company to
is your,
see in order to exempt yourself, you would have to meet both. So if you owned less than 1% and it was more than $5,000, then it's not presumed insignificant. It's a double negative. It works exactly the opposite.
I understand the amendment, and I'm going to maintain an objection to the amendment, and though I do understand it, it's the ethics code for me is complicated enough. I do appreciate your point of view as it would relate to something that's worth this much that could escalate astronomically into something that's worth this much. Is there other discussion on amendment
Mr.
number 21? Representative Cockett.
And maybe we could get some help from Mr. Jones on this. It seems to me that if you're going to have an income that from any stock ownership that's over $1,000, you're going to have to report it anyway. Yeah, maybe I should have that confirmed, because this is an ownership that's presumed less than $5,000. That's insignificant. But if he earns more than $1,000 off of this, he's got to report it.
Representative Coghill, through the chair, that's correct if you're one of those that's required to report. But this is under the Ethics Act that applies top to bottom to everybody. Okay. And not all of us in the executive branch have to file the financial disclosures. In addition, Representative Grinberg made the point about increasing the value of your interest. Well, that's exactly why the language, as it exists in the bill already, says a presumption. We can reach those cases where my current interest is worth less than $5,000, but the action I take will dramatically increase the value of that interest. I also agree with Representative Grinberg's analysis with respect to Representative Samuel's question. Because it's framed in the negative and then has an and in there, you would have to meet both criteria in order for it to be considered insignificant. It would have to be both less than $5,000 and less than 1% of the total value to be considered insignificant under the amendment.
Can you say one thing? I totally agree with what Mr. Jones said. And I just would add one thing, though. The question is, where should the presumption lie? And if our goal is public disclosure and free from even the appearance of an impropriety, we're only talking about a presumption. And it would seem to me that if there's a situation in which the ownership of the ABC Corporation by my action might very well increase the value of those shares, the presumption should be that it's significant.
Yes, the point is well taken. The other presumption I think is reasonable is that the ethics code is complicated enough and doesn't need to be complicated by double negatives in statute. So I will maintain the objection. Is there any other discussion on amendment number 21? Susan, will you take the roll, please?
And this is for amendment 21, which is 0.34 or 0.34, right?
That is correct.
Representative Samuels?
No.
Representative Lynn?
Yes.
Representative Holmes?
No.
Thank you. Representative Gruenberg?
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom?
No.
Pardon?
No, I apologize.
Representative Coghill?
No.
Representative Ramirez?
No.
Two yes, five no.
So amendment number 21 fails. We have before us amendment number 22 by Representative Coghill, 25-GH1059/O. 0.34. I don't have the rest of
37. Okay.
I just have O, but I believe this is not. That's yes, this is the one.
I'll move number 22, Mr. Chair.
I don't see the other.
I don't have that point.
I'll start with page 25, line 27.
Yes, it begins with page 25, line 27. So I have the amendment number 22 before us by Representative Dahlstrom. Do you object for the purpose of discussion?
I got my name on it, but I still object.
Okay.
Nicely done. So we can hear it.
Okay. Representative Coghill objects. We have amendment number 22 before us.
Mr. Chairman, could I have Mr. Jones speak to it, please?
Yes, give me just one second, please. Okay, so this has the wrong author on here also.
It's just a technical amendment. It just conforms language.
Okay. I follow you. I see it. I understand what happened. Okay. So this is a conforming amendment. Representative Coghill, you need to discuss this, or do you want to withdraw?
If you guys see that it's conforming, that's fine with me, and I would withdraw my objection.
Mr. Chair, you see, the language says, line 26, stock or other ownership interest, and this just says value of stock or other ownership interest. It just makes it conform.
Okay.
True cleanup.
Okay. The objection is withdrawn. Seeing no objections, amendment number 22 passes. We now have before us amendment number 23-GH1059/O.
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
They're all numbered the same up there. You just have to refer to the page.
Page 26, line 22. Moved by Dahlstrom, Representative Samuels objects. Representative Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, this goes to the issue of the difference between those required to file a statement and a policymaking position. Maybe we should have Mr. Jones speak to this one.
Mr. Jones?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Coghill, thank you. This is just cleanup language. What we're trying to do with this amendment is clarify who it is that is subject to the lobbying restrictions under Section 37 and the restrictions on serving on certain boards of organizations under Section 38 of the bill. We attempted in the State Affairs Committee to identify those policymaking positions in the Office of the Governor that would be subject to both of these restrictions. One of the concerns we had with the choice that we made in the State Affairs Committee was that perhaps some members of the governor's office would have to file statements with the APOC because they run for school board or something like that, and that could create confusion. So to clarify that and avoid that ambiguity, we propose this amendment.
Is there further discussion on amendment number 23? Representative Grunberg.
Just a technical question. If the members would look at that section, the tagline reads, report of financial and business interests. And then the text says, shall file a statement giving income sources and business interests. Do you wish to say, rather than just file a statement and referencing the statute, say, statement of financial and business interests? Does that, because people may not be familiar with the statute number, but what is, if I may, maybe Ms. Miles, this goes to you, right? Did they file this with you, or do they file it with which office?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, statements under 3950 are filed with APOC.
What is the title? Are they statements of business and financial interest? Because that's what people normally would look at.
It's all part of the annual public official financial disclosure report. I believe it's a Schedule G.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I could be wrong.
I won't make a motion.
Representative Samuels?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I will defer this question if you wish, but while we're on these sections here, I wanted to discuss the in Section 36, the two-year prohibition, and in Section 37, the one-year prohibition for these various people in the executive branch, and it would fit into this amendment to change that, but it obviously that's a far larger policy call than this, which is a cleanup amendment. So if you want to get through them all, that's fine, but I'd like sometime Mr. Jones to comment on, you've got some people, it seems almost at a lower level, but have to wait longer than some people. The governor themselves has to wait 1 year. So I won't offer that amendment or have that discussion.
Let's, let's make a notation to come back to that tomorrow, please. Is the objection maintained on number 23? The objection is removed. We have amendment number 23 before us. Seeing no objection, amendment number 23 passes. We have before us now amendment number 24 by Representative Lim.
And I move amendment number 24.
25-GH1059/0.24. Wayne?
I'll object to discussion.
Dahlstrom objects. We have number 24 before us for purposes of discussion. Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I already did.
It's been moved and objected to.
Right. I'll move it again. I think all of us are opposed to nepotism, different flavors of it, and they could be conflicts of interest between various family members working together in various positions, and we all understand that. But Alaska is a very, very small state. Sometimes I facetiously would say that the family tree in Alaska looks like a telephone pole. And so there has to be a certain element of common sense involved here. You get a couple, get out on the highway someplace, some flaggers out there, nothing around for 50 miles. We had to have some common sense to make this thing work, and that's the whole purpose of this. And we have somebody online here, I forget her name, who spoke to us earlier, who can speak particularly to this.
We do. Is Ms. Dragas still with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You are patient. Thank you very much for waiting for us, Heidi. I Hope you haven't been too unimpressed by the proceedings.
Oh, no, I'm having a great time.
Oh, excellent.
You're talking to one for all.
So are we. So are we. Did you get a copy? Did you get a copy of Representative Lynn's amendment?
I did. Thank you.
Can we please treat you like an ex officio member of the Judiciary Committee for spending so much time waiting for us? Representative Lynn, if you'll continue, and then when it's appropriate, if you'll invite Ms. Dragas to chime in, please.
I've basically made my comments on the whole idea is to make things, you know, make things practical so we can operate in a practical manner and still do the job that we were elected to do.
All right, and Ms. Dragas. The language that we have here, and I assume that, did you forward this to us, or how did we, is that correct?
Yes, attached to her statement.
Okay, and so the language we have from you is it is unlawful for a person who is the spouse of or is related by blood within and including the second degree of kindred to the executive head of a principal state department or agency to be employed in that department or agency. And if you would just... if you would put that in plain language for me, that's correct. That's
for all of us.
This is the statute.
Were you quoting? I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm confused. Were you quoting the language from the nepotism statute?
I was. Yes. So
this is an amendment to
that. I understand. So, Representative Lynn, you have Ms. Dragas's amendment. Is that correct?
This is the amendment I have. It's 0.24, and this addresses the issue.
Excellent. Representative Grunberg.
If the members would look, if I may, Mr. Representative.
I'm not the chairman. You have to ask.
Okay. Yeah. I'll ask you.
Thank you. You may.
I dealt with my colleague left in the previous committee.
Point taken, Representative. Yeah.
That's a tough thing to say. Okay.
God bless us, everybody.
We have Ms. Dragas's memo. The last page of that is her proposed amendment. And what Dan Wayne has done is taken her amendment and put it into our proper form.
And this is the Representative Lynn amendment being offered, takes Ms. Dragas's concerns and puts it into appropriate amendment form.
Essentially so, Amendment 24.
And so we have before us Amendment number 24. Would you like to speak to it briefly, Ms. Dragas?
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I did speak to this yesterday. I don't have much new to add, except for I think that Representative Lynn hit the nail on the head. I mean, this is a common sense amendment. The only thing we're trying to do is to clarify the scope of the Ethics Act and to realign it with the policy that had been longstanding in this state family members may not work together if they are in a supervisory relationship. And what this amendment will do is just clarify that is the scope of the Ethics Act as it pertains to family members. And like I spoke yesterday, new policy by the administration is creating a lot of problems with non-supervisory family members working together, especially in smaller rural and native communities, and so we're just trying to clarify that to put forth a common sense approach under the Ethics Act, and I think that this amendment will do that.
And Ms. Dragas, before I take a question from Representative Samuels, I gather that you don't object if one spouse works in natural resources and another spouse works in labor and commerce.
I mean, as long as they're not in it, I guess I would need some clarification. Are you saying that
you're not? Your intent is not to keep one could be a supervisor in natural resources, and the other spouse could be a supervisor in labor and commerce. So you're not objecting to that. You're just saying that two supervisory members shouldn't be in the same government department.
Yeah, I mean, basically what we're saying is that if the two family members are in a supervisory relationship, so a father is supervising his son or his daughter, or two brothers where one is supervising the other, this will clarify what we've always meant by what a supervisor's role is, which is what has been longstanding in state regulations. So as long as the two family members aren't in a supervisory relationship, that's what we're trying to clarify. If they are supervising, one is supervising the other, then no, we have no objection. We believe that that is problematic, and state law requires that those types of situations be scrutinized, and they're typically not allowed. We're just clarifying that if it's non-supervisory, that shouldn't be a problem under the Ethics Act.
Thank you. Representative Samuel?
Thank you. And I'd like a question for Mr. Jones, actually. If, once again, looking at the perceptions, if I am a supervisor at DOT on one project and I don't have direct supervisor over the flagger, but boy, my buddy Bob hires my daughter. The perception, I assume that since it doesn't supersede 3990.020, that it doesn't affect any of the upper level positions. Is that true right off the bat? I mean, if I'm the commissioner of DOT, I cannot hire my kid. That just doesn't change that.
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, that's correct.
And I'd just like the administration's opinion on the perception then of potential nepotism, where you get into these, what are the mid-level management jobs, if you will, where, you know, Nancy and I are at the same level and Nancy hires my kid.
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, under the existing Ethics Act, without this amendment, the Ethics Act would prohibit anyone from granting an unwarranted benefit to someone else based on inappropriate considerations, and one would be, well, it's going to make my boss happy. One of our concerns about this amendment is that it would allow someone to recommend a promotion, to assign overtime, and to evaluate an immediate family member, because those things are not included in this definition of supervision. This definition of supervision comes from the regulations or statutes that apply to determining who belongs in which bargaining unit. And so these are the criteria that the Labor Relations Agency uses when it's deciding whether you go in a supervisory unit or in a rank and file unit. There was an ethics opinion issued by our office in 2005 that said that it was inappropriate for someone to have authority over assignment of overtime and evaluation of an immediate family member. In response to that ethics opinion, the Department of Administration adopted a policy that is absolutely consistent with the direction the Department of Law gave in that ethics opinion. This amendment would undermine both of those and would go in the opposite direction of the other provisions that are included in this bill by loosening rather than tightening the restrictions under the Ethics Acts.
Very good. Excellent explanation. Representative Dahlstrom?
Just a question. Representative Samuels, I think your example was excellent. Does this pertain to members who are in, say, a commissioner or deputy commissioner position and potential spouses or whatever in the legislative branch?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, it does not apply to the legislative branch.
Or executive.
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, it applies solely to the executive branch.
Thank you for that clarification.
Very good. Are there other questions regarding other committee discussion regarding Amendment Number 24? Representative Lynn, thank you for bringing this before us. Ms. Strigas, so we appreciate very much you bringing this to our attention. We're glad that we could act on it, and not only are we citizen legislators, but it's good that we are this close to the public. We appreciate you weighing in yesterday through public testimony and to assist us in drafting an amendment that improved this bill and improves executive ethics going forward. Thank you very much for your assistance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's a pleasure. All right, is the objection removed to Amendment Number 24?
I remove my objection.
The objection is removed.
I'll maintain the objection. I want to vote on it.
Okay.
And if I can comment.
Yes, then Representative Samuels.
The entire debate and the entire bill has been on legislators and legislative staff and upper management people, and now we are getting into mid-level and lower management people and bargaining unit politics here that the rest of the bill didn't. It was all about disclosures and being transparent, and now we're on to me it's a whole nother subject. So I'm going to maintain an objection.
Okay. Representative Grunberg, then Holmes.
Just to respond to that is not correct. 39.50, which is the Financial Disclosure Act, only applies to upper-level executive people. But 39.52, which a large portion of this bill does concern, applies to all employees in the executive branch. And I would refer the members to sections 34 to the end of the bill. Actually, it's sections 34 through 40 all apply to all levels in the executive branch.
Discussion here. Representative Grunberg, you directed us to sections 35 to 40. Representative Holmes, you had a comment to make.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my thought on this amendment, if we're going to be moving ahead with it today, which it looks like we will, is that I'm not feeling sufficiently versed in what this does to approve it at this time. But I would think that it brings up an issue that we should maybe look into later and see whether there might be some movement either within this bill or as a separate issue later. I just don't know yet at this point.
Thank you, Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My request is basically the same that I heard from Representative Holmes. I would ask if we could hold this at least overnight and get some further clarification.
Okay. Now let's table amendment number 24.
If I just may make a closing comment, I think it's probably good to hold it. The problem is the legislation as it is casts too wide a net. And the little guy out on a highway someplace, 50 miles from no place, gets caught up in issues that would more rightfully belong to other levels of the place where he works. And so I think we need to look at this. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you very much. With our remaining time today,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
We have one more amendment, I believe. Yeah. It's amendment 0.32.
Well, I think we withdrawn.
Well, should it have been with? We're having that redraft.
Yes, it says.
Okay, I'm not going to offer that at this point.
Okay, very good. So, with our remaining few minutes, I'd like to take up in your packet the amendment regarding pension forfeiture. Which is amendment 0.06.
Well, we've got to find that here.
Number, Mr. Chairman? Amendment number? You offer
amendment will be amendment number 25. No, we did not offer.
And it's 0.06.
There it is, right there.
Yes.
You have it?
I'm not sure I have it.
Oh, it's right.
My mind's going to blank.
It's by Ramris 25-GH1059/0.6.
And I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
Amendment number 25 before us.
I'll object.
And Representative Coghill objects.
And Mr. Chair, I don't have a copy. She's making a copy.
Okay. Representative Grunberg.
I do support the concept here. My concern, and I had looked at this, is that I would like to get before we vote on this, I would like a legal opinion as to its constitutionality in view of Article 12, I think it's Section 7 of the state constitution, which provides that membership, if I may read,
yes,
retirement systems, membership in employee retirement systems of the state or its political subdivisions shall constitute a contractual relationship. Accrued benefits of these systems shall not be diminished or impaired. There is a similar congressional statute to this, and one of the representatives, Randy Cunningham, I think was subject to forfeiture under that, and but there's no similar federal prohibition, and I think in the Judiciary Committee we need to have a legal opinion on this before we vote.
I don't disagree, Representative Grunberg. I would direct members to page 2, lines 21 through 23 of the amendment, section B, pension benefits and employee contributions that accrue to a person before the date of the person's commission of the offense described in subsection A of this section are not diminished or impaired by that subsection. Representative Samuels.
Thank you. I've got one question for you, Mr. Chairman, or perhaps if Mr. Jones drafted it. I want to make absolutely clear that on page 2, lines 19 and 20, so that the offense is in connection with the person's official duties, so you accept a bribe or you get convicted of something now. And then that question, I wanted to clarify that it means what I think it means. It means okay. To me. And secondly, even if Department of Law come back and says there's a constitutional problem, I think that we should vote on it and make somebody sue us on that on those grounds.
Right. Mr. Jones, would you like to make some comments, please?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman. Representative Samuels, I played no part in drafting this, so I can't take any credit.
You can
for
rocks
it.
Then. But,
I can offer you my reading of it, which I believe is that it says, or it means what it says, and that is that the offense has to be in connection with official duty. I think the whole purpose behind the amendment is to avoid giving a state benefit to someone who's misused an official office.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Okay, so thank you, Mr. Chair. So for me, what you just said, misuse of office, someone is a child molester or they're very heavily involved in child porn or whatever, they happen to use their state computer for that on off time or whenever, it's not related to, they may be doing their other job extremely well, they're charged with that, convicted, what happens?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, if any state equipment were involved, I'd want to go for a judge to convict that person and seek forfeiture based on that. And I think if any aspect of the state office were used, there'd be a good argument that that is an offense that was committed in connection with the person's official duty.
Okay, and follow up, Mr. Chair. Even if it was in no aspect of state property or anything involved there, they commit a heinous crime. They're doing their other job 100%. The rest of us are all standing there with their mouths open, just can't believe what we've just learned. What happens then?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, if there were no connection to performance of the official duties or use of state equipment, et cetera, I don't see that this would provide for forfeiture.
So while they're in the penitentiary, we're going to send their pension? We need to create another bill if we wanted to send their pension fund to the victim?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, I think you're absolutely right. I don't think that this would provide for that.
Excellent direction.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Grunberg, quickly.
Mr. Jones, do you feel that the provision on page 2, lines 21 through 23, saves the bill from unconstitutionality under Article 1, Section 7?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I'm not in a position to give you a off-the-cuff constitutional opinion, even if I were otherwise qualified. However, I think one of the concerns under that constitutional provision would be changing the rules of the game after someone has already entered the system. And so it may be that in order to be constitutional, these changes would have to be applicable only to those who enter the retirement system after the effective date of this enactment. That's a maybe. Again, it's an off-the-cuff reaction. But that may be the way a court would interpret the constitutional requirement.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Jones. All right, I'm mindful of the clock. We've had a very productive 2 hours today. Let me remind the members that tomorrow we will, and the public, that we will take public testimony from 1 to 1:30. We would invite any member of the public who wishes to weigh in on any of these issues or the bill in its entirety to join us. If we have a lot of testimony, then we will limit testimony out to 3 minutes. We'll table Amendment 25 to
25, right?
Amendment number 25 until.
I've got a legal opinion. Would you like me to go through?
Be delighted.
And Mr. Jones, through the chair, if you could take a look at this overnight too. I strongly support this, but I don't want to.
Point made. Tomorrow from 1:30 until 2 o'clock, we will investigate blind trusts. We'll be joined by Representative Seaton, who has done some work on this matter. Dave Shaftel will join us online. We also will hopefully have an amendment drafted that addresses the Newman rules. We have a couple of other amendments, and if we have enough content to go the full session tomorrow, we will. If we do not, then we will likely adjourn tomorrow and take up the bill for final discussion and passage on Friday, so that we allow the public an extra day to weigh in on it, as well as members who may have some lingering concerns. I thought we had a very productive and constructive day today, and we'll see everybody tomorrow at 1 o'clock. We are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.